Welcome to Positive Personal Power with hope, aspiration, and encouragement. Our goal is to build and enhance people's confidence and strength to handle life's challenges. Now, let me introduce you to your host, Nathaniel Skula.
Today, I am joined by Michael Tobin again and Graham Gooch. Graham Gooch, for people who don't know, was one of the most successful international batsmen of his generation. And welcome, Graham. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I remember growing up as a kid and hearing about your exploits.
Must have a good memory, that's all I can say.
I don't remember much anymore.
It's lovely to be on your show. You probably don't remember that the film was in black and white in those days.
Well, I remember having three channels.
But you're still involved with the England setup, aren't you?
Well, not really with the England team. I'm still ambassador at Essex Cricket. So that's always been a love of mine, being involved with Essex. I first played a second team game for them in 1968. And then I played first team cricket and joined the staff in 1974. So I've been there a long time. Been captain, been a player, obviously. Been the coach, we don't have selectors, committee member. I'm the ambassador now. So I've always been there, supporting Essex, doing things for Essex and following their progress. And of course, if you like your cricket, which I know you do, we are the current county champions.
Oh, indeed.
If this season gets cancelled, we might be county champions for another year. So that won't be no bad thing. But they've had a bit of success lately, so that's good. And my other involvement with cricket really is, apart from going to the games as one of the Professional Cricket Association ambassadors, I'm also, for my sins, the president of the Professional Cricket Association.
Okay.
So I'm not really involved with England now. When I finished coaching with England maybe 5-6 years ago, my sort of involvement ceased then.
I remember seeing you throwing balls at people in the nets at Lord's during the test matches back at people. And I remember you were using one of those like throwy sticky things.
Well, the players call it a dog stick, but the official name is a sidearm. And you may or may not know that the story of the sidearm is that a guy, I live near Chelmsford in Essex, and there's a little village just outside, literally a couple of miles, called Rittle, and spelt WRITTLE. And the guy who developed and designed the sidearm, that you know, the throw-in device for net practice and that, which is a brilliant device, and all the coaches around the world use it, have done for the last probably 10 years. It's been on the market now. Yeah. A guy called Frank Thorogood was a farmer, okay, and he's a local cricketer, club cricketer. And basically, he used to take his dog out with the similar sort of device they throw the ball with for the dogs. And he thought, you know, he thought about this, and he got a bit of a grant for developing it. And he won the Barclays Business Award for that round about 2009, 2010. And that's how it all started. And now it is a universally used device all around the world by top-class coaches, coaching kids and all that. And really, he approached me to help promote it, you know, way, way back, just about the time I started working for England. And I remember when we were on the tour to Australia, when Andrew Strauss was captain and we won 3-1, that was the first time really it was on show in international matches, and we had them, but the Aussies didn't have them because it was only just new to the scene. But it's been a great device, and you you mentioned Lords. I remember as batting coach, of course, you get to throw to all the players pretty much, and they're insatiable with the number of balls they want thrown to them. And I counted up how many balls I reckon I threw over the 7-day period of a test match, okay? So you've got 2 days practice before the game starts, then the 5 days of the game, mainly in the morning. So how many balls do you reckon I threw over 7 days?
Well, in the mornings, I reckon probably about, can't be more than about 20 a day. So that's 100, 150, 200.
Over 7 days?
Yeah.
It's more like 1,500.
Jeez.
1,500 throws. Okay.
No, probably you need one of those machines, otherwise your arm's going to be ruined.
Well, the sidearm is brilliant because you can generate pace, okay, on the ball. Because when you're throwing in your own arm, I mean, obviously some people have got stronger arms than others and they can throw the ball quicker. But if you were throwing with your arm, you would not be able to do that. Because some players like the ball thrown to them. Some players like net practice in the traditional manner with bowlers. And you get a combination of the two. You still get a bit of the bowling machine, the old bowling machines. They're normally used more indoors, you know, like winter practice or off-season practice. Mm-hmm. Right. So out on the field, it's normally either people bowling, net bowlers, or this device. And, it's been a revolution for coaches.
Wow. That's interesting. So I've got a couple of questions up here. What is it like to be a leader of men who, in their own right, are already top of their game?
Well, I think firstly, to be captain or a leader, you've got to want to do it, okay? Now, what do I mean? How do I define want to do it? It's got to be more, I think, than just thinking, well, being captain, top of the tree, you know, having the armband, the pips on the shoulder, getting to call the shots is nice, but you've got to want to do the job, because there's a lot of things involved with captaining a cricket team. You know, you are the tactician, you are the counsellor for all your players, you are the motivator, you're the one who has to organise them. Obviously, maybe in the last 20 years, coaches have taken a much bigger role in how they influence the team, how they prepare the team. But generally, cricket is about leading the team, you know, on the field. So I think it's important that you really got to want to do it. You've got to be a bit of a student of the game. You've got to be good at handling people. You've got to be a good man manager. You've got to be a good shoulder to cry on sometimes. You've got to be able to crack the whip sometimes. So there's multitasking, really. And not every leader and every captain does it the same way. Some people are, you know, psychologically great man management. Mike really comes to mind there. Some people are, you know, people who lead from the front, who set the example, who go out and lead the way. And I always enjoyed that aspect of it. And I think was an advantage for me, because opening the batting, you get to go in first, obviously. You get to set the tone for your team by, you know, being up front with the bat. And I always thought that was an advantage, actually. So, it's a tough job. You get some real dark times and you get some real good times. But, I mean, some people would say that you're only as good as the team you've got, but you've got to get the best out of that team. And it's the same in business. It's the same in any sort of management roles. In any walk of life, it's getting the best out of people, it's connecting with them, engaging with them, and knowing how to, you know, find a way into that person so that they respond in a positive manner. And all different types of people respond in different ways.
Got you.
Do you think that if you're a good captain and you've got a bad but willing team around you, you can play above yourselves as a team.
I think the sum of all the parts, even if they're not the most talented team, if they all pull together, they all have a focus in the right direction, they all work really hard, you know, at their games, and they all gel together, I think you can play above your station. And I think cricket's one of them games, and some people say momentum plays a part in a lot of sports, but you know, if you all believe in each other, you can win games where sometimes you don't really deserve to win, you know, and you can sort of nick games that maybe it's not going your way, but because you hold strong and your character's good as a unit, you can get through. Of course, the flip side of that is that, you know, sometimes it can go the other way. You know, if you get a talented side, but they're not always pulling in the same direction, and they've got their own agendas, a lot of different individuals maybe in that team, and that can be difficult. So I think captain in a cricket team is unlike captain in possibly soccer or rugby. Might be slightly different because captain on the field probably has to call the plays, if you see what I mean, if I use an Americanism, has to call the plays, you know, what, you know, how they're going to do with the line out, the scrum, what play they're going to go off the back of it. I know they've rehearsed it all, but you have to make those calls. And of course, in cricket, we don't have a microphone system, although Bob Woolmer, for a few years, the late great Bob Woolmer, you know, tried it as a coach, tried to connect with his captain with a little earphone and whatever.
Oh, really?
But generally on the field, you know, you have to be adaptable as a captain. You know, you might have a plan, you might have worked out that plan, but sometimes it needs changing straight away. It's not working. So you've got to be a great reader of the game. But I think, you know, that there's a couple of basics, and I don't know how it relates to business. I'm sure it's the same as well. You know, as captaincy, you don't have to be liked, but you have to be respected.
Right.
Okay. To get on and get the best out of people. Don't always have to be all their best mates. And I think you have to remember, you know, you're with them, not one of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Also, you know, things like you never ask anyone to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself. There is a few basics that I think you have to adhere to, because I think if you're in charge, you've got to just be... set yourself aside from the players a little bit. You can't be full on with them mixing all. But you can be mixing, but you know what I mean. It's quite a difficult, I think, a difficult balance to play. You
know, yeah, it is. I mean, I've found that in business, especially in the sales side of things, you get really good salespeople, and then you know you promote them to a sales manager, and the whole thing falls apart because they're still trying to be the buddy. And if suddenly you stop doing that, it also then implies like you give this sort of aloof type impression to people. That also upsets people as well, you know, especially when you've been a friend earlier. And I think it's much harder to promote from within because of that. When you've got someone going from one job as being part of a group of peers to being that group's leader, I think it's really, really tough transition. Sometimes it's easier to get someone from the outside in.
Yeah. I mean, the analogy there in sport is that I think it's quite difficult in most sports to be part of the team and then you get promoted to be the coach or something like that.
Yeah.
Because you're coming from the... dressing room atmosphere and environment. I said the analogy is that in sport, what you were saying about being one of the boys or girls and then being promoted from within, you still try and play that role, but it's difficult because when something has to be said or done or tell someone this and that, you need to be slightly apart from them. You need to be slightly not divorced from them, but you can't just, you know, go out and do all the things that all the boys do, if you know what I mean. And the analogy is that, you know, in sport, you often see someone who's in the team, football, rugby, cricket, it's a difficult role to be promoted to be coach straight away from within that dressing room, you know, because suddenly you're one of the players and then you're the person who is determining their livelihoods, determining their careers, you know, and you're better off, I think, if you want to be desire to be a coach, if you go away from that team and do something else or go work for someone else, and then you come back maybe a few years later, then that's different. Yeah. But that's always different. I mean, it does happen occasionally, but not very often.
Yeah.
So David Gower said this about you. He said, "I don't have the same ability that Graham Gooch has to produce something very close to his best every time he plays," right? How did you do that? Like, did you have some sort of, I don't know, ritual or something that you did before you went on to play that enabled you to do that? Or,
well, I mean, look, firstly, David Gower is one of England's greatest ever players. We played our careers in parallel, and we played together, had umpteen successes, quite a few failures, but umpteen successes down the years, captained in various sides. You know, he captained England in 85 when we won the Ashes, and then it didn't go quite so well for him in 89. But, you know, got ultimate respect for David, was a sublime player and a player that everyone would want to pay money to watch. And he was brilliant for England. I'm not quite sure what he meant, but I mean, look, I'm a believer in your career and in life that you evolve yourself. Okay. So as you start off, your pool of knowledge is not that great, maybe, but if you're smart, you evolve yourself. So what do I mean? I mean, for me in sport, it's made up of maybe four basic things. First one is attitude. Attitude controls everything. Attitude controls where you want to go, how hard you're going to work. Then you have technical ability, which is different for everyone, but getting the best out of that technical ability and improving your technical ability. Third one is knowledge. What is knowledge? As I said at the beginning, pool of knowledge. At the beginning, you're inexperienced, but if you're smart, you watch other people, you talk to other people, you evolve yourself with the knowledge and how you play in different places in the world, in different conditions. And then the last one, which is very important in our game, is concentration. Because without concentration, you can't score runs, okay? Because you can make mistakes. But concentration is key. So I think if you put all these things into operation, you work hard on all these different facets. And remember, in our world, David Gowers and myself and other people who score runs for a living and play for their country or for their team, doesn't matter. The big difference in our sport, okay, and in our particular part of our sport, is one mistake for us and it's the end of our day. That's mm-hmm. the big difference. So it's not like a tennis player. It's not like a golfer. It's not like a bowler. Whereas you play a bad shot, you plan another shot 20 seconds later. We may be akin to a downhill skier or a Formula One racer. One mistake, end of your day. You have to wait to the next game or wherever to put that right. So you have to cash in and do well when you get the opportunity, when things are on your side and you just make it count. And by getting all those aspects and facets of the game right, doesn't guarantee success, but it narrows down the margins of failure. And as I got older and as I evolved, you know, through the first part of my career to the later part of my career, when I had my best time, which was the time when most people are past their best, mm-hmm. you know, I'd learned a lot and evolved myself, and I managed to be much more consistent than I was in the earlier part of my career.
Right.
It was that consistency, I guess, that he was referring to, right? It was the, you know, you knew that it was highly unlikely you were going to get a bad innings out of Graham.
Well, look, we all make mistakes and you all get good balls. And but, you know, you learn that priceless skill of how to manage your batting in my world, you know, manage my skills and cut out the mistakes. Cutting out the errors doesn't mean not scoring runs, doesn't mean being defensive, is playing better percentages. And I'm sure in both your worlds, you know, you take the percentages, you play the percentages, and you learn, you know, the things you can do and the things you cannot do. And going back to one of my obviously favourite players, and one I know very well, as you know, a coach, Alistair Cook, okay? his biggest asset from the beginning, when I first met him about 2002, 2003, was this lad had the priceless ability of knowing exactly what he could do and what he couldn't do. And he played within those parameters. Okay. Over the years, he expanded his game. He expanded his range of technical ability, the shots he could play, the way he could compose and compile an innings. But he always knew to play within his limits. And most of my career, in the people I've encountered in sport, that's a skill that some learn as they get older. Some never learn it at all. But he had that in place all the time. And his challenge as his career went on was to improve and enhance his technical skills and not his mind. His strength of character and his temperament were solid from the word go to when he finished.
Do you reckon that's something to do with the fact he's a farmer? He's got that kind of...
Well, he wasn't always a farmer. He wasn't always. He married Alice, and Alice's family is the farmer. So he's a converted farmer, I would say. But, you know, if you asked Alistair, he would relate to when he was a choir boy at St. Paul's Cathedral, that he would say that the concentration and the discipline was sort of put into him at a very young age, because they had to be very disciplined to sing in the choir, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And all those sort of skills that he probably didn't even realise at that very young age sort of served him well when it came to his batting later on. So it takes all sorts. It takes all sorts. And you can pick up knowledge, going back to my knowledge, you can pick up knowledge from anywhere. And if one little piece of knowledge, as you know, in your life, helps you perform better, then you pick up another little bit of knowledge. And some things you'll say, well, that's good, but I can't do that, or that doesn't work for me, but that does. And I don't know, you tell me. The smart player or smart performer, whatever walk of life, picks up the knowledge which he thinks can improve him or her, okay? And the other skill is to disregard all the other stuff you get put in front of you, okay? Yeah. It's not that it's bad information. It's not that it's not given in good faith. It just doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot. So this is going to hurt, this question, yeah? But I think the
You're
outcome...
You're not talking about West Ham, are you?
No, I'm not. So how does it feel to, like, lose to the Australians despite you being at the top of your game?
Well, it happened to me quite a lot. I played in 7 Ashes series. We won 3 and lost 4. So I know the hurt of losing to Australia. And of course, it didn't start great for me, because I made my debut, as you know, maybe 1975 at Edgbaston against Ian Chappell's Australians. I compiled a pair, 2 noughts. And as I often say to people, it's quite convenient to have your first test score in your surname. Okay. Look, defeat, losing is part of the game, and it's never nice, and it never sits easily, but you become a little bit accustomed to it, and you just work on the basis that I don't want to make the same mistakes again, and you hope you win more games than you lose. But I mean, Australians are to be respected, because they play the game hard, they play it tough, there's no quarter given, they're really motivated, and they have that winning mentality. So I think there's a lot to be respected from Australian cricket.
Yeah. So what kept you going in the hard times?
Good question. I had some hard years. As I said, you know, you evolve yourself, and early on, when I changed from being a middle order batsman to a opening batsman about 1978, 5 years after I'd started playing, professionally. I had to, you know, remodel my technique and stuff like that. So you have to look at yourself. And I think you always have to believe, you know, in life in particular, but in sport, you've got to believe that you are good enough to do the job. You know, you are good enough. And it's interesting because when I worked as a coach with England, it was quite big for our players, for us to convince new players coming into the England side that, you know, people in the media are going to say this about you, that about you, whatever. You've got to understand that they've got a job to do. It's not personal, but they're just giving an opinion, what they see. So you've got to be bigger and stronger than that and disregard that and not be sidetracked from, you know, outside criticism. So some players are born with belief. Ian Botham, ultimate believer in his own game, that he could turn a game and do this and that. Some have to work on it. And I think I'd probably fall into that category, that at the beginning, you know, and let's be fair, all of us three here, having doubts, having anxiety, having moments where you think this is going to work or not going to work, you know, is human nature, is normal human emotions. The trick is to believe that today it's going to work for me. I'm going to do well today. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's not that the thoughts are not there, but you've got to put them to the back of your mind and put the positive things to the front of your mind. You have to convince yourself. And I think that's a skill. And it's you have to accept that there's doubts there, whether it's going to be a good day today, but you have to live with those doubts and control them. You mustn't let them consume you. And I think that's the same for everyone, whether you're taking an exam, whether you've got to have a confrontation with someone, you've got to tell them you didn't like this or whatever, you know, whatever. It's the same sort of thoughts go through your mind. You've got to believe you're doing the right thing and you're on the right track.
Yeah, yeah. What I did want to ask you about, which I think is really quite interesting, you know, you went on this rebel tour, and I actually remember that when I was a kid. I remember you went on this rebel tour to South Africa, and I was like, what the hell's going on? Like, this is really dangerous, right? So what were your motivations around that?
1982. So in those days, you were contracted to tour with England. Okay. So I went to the tour finish, which in this case, in February 82, the tour to India and Sri Lanka finished. Then we had a month with no cricket before my Essex contract started. So some of us accepted a private contract to go play cricket in South Africa, which we knew wouldn't go unnoticed. South Africa was banned from Test cricket. We didn't play Test cricket. We played as a privately organised SAB Breweries 11. But obviously, they were all ex-England players who were playing. I think, look, in previous years, I played in Cape Town for Greenpoint Cricket Club. They were the first team, in the Cape Town League to have a non-white player playing. So cricket was starting to look at this and make changes. And then, you know, I was sympathetic to what the cricketers were trying to do. They were trying to keep their cricket alive, and they were trying to integrate in a very difficult system with apartheid. Obviously, no one supports apartheid. My only way of earning a living was to play cricket. Now, a businessman like Mike could go to South Africa and work, a lawyer, an accountant, you know, a plumber, electrician, anyone could go there and work. Lots of players were playing in South Africa individually. So I think I felt that, you know, if others were stopped from going there, then that would be fair enough. But, you know, we had only one way of earning a living, playing cricket. So it was a commercial offer. I wasn't breaking any contracts or anything, and we didn't do anything wrong with the laws of our country. The reason we got banned was because the other country said they wouldn't tour England if they picked us. So we got embroiled in a political row.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been to India. Okay. This is not a justification. I've been to India many times. And you go into a hotel in India where there's lots of jeweler shops. You might know in hotels, and they have all the emeralds and rubies and that, but they also have diamonds, and you know where the diamonds come from.
Mm. Well, we'll come from Kimberley and places like that.
They come from De Beers, yeah. Of course they do.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that your governments would not stop trading with South Africa, okay? But they do want their sportsmen to adhere to bans.
Got it. Yeah. So, it was a commercial decision. I get that. I just thought I'd ask, you know, it's we've got to do things to eat, right? I mean, that's at the end of the day, what we've got to do, feed our families. I mean, that's what we're talking about.
I mean, that was our way of earning a living, obviously. Now, people always ask me, would I make the same decision again? And it's a difficult one. I don't think about it and have sleepless nights about it. You know, I have a clear conscience. I know the cricketers I played with and against were trying to make changes in that country. And of course, in 1992, they did make changes. Nelson Mandela came out of prison and everything changed for the better.
Yeah.
It was a decision I made in good faith, and I have to live with that.
Yeah. Well, we often make these decisions in life. It's what life's all about, isn't it, at the end of the day? It's the way it is.
I suffered a year, you know, when I went to West Indies with England in 86, I got a lot of political backlash, really, from some of the governments in that country, yeah. Although we were accepted back in into the fold, so to speak, we'd had our ban and whatever. And of course, there were subsequent tours after that, which...
Hmm. Oh, we lost you again there.
Flawed. So what excites you then nowadays then about the world and cricket?
What a question.
The big one, right? It's a biggie, yeah.
Well, West Ham United might stay up if the season don't finish. That might excite me. We haven't lost for about 8 weeks anyway, so that's good. I'm just very fortunate to have a good family. I've got three daughters, my partner Julia. We're one of the lucky ones still working the game of cricket a little bit, getting on a bit now. We like our walking, we like our fundraising, did the coast to coast walk, and we do a few things we like. So I still like exercising. I'll probably, during this time, terrible time over these last 7 weeks with the COVID-19, I've been in the gym at home more than ever. I've lost nearly a stone in weight.
Really?
Yeah, the wine stock has taken a bit of a hiccup in the evenings. I'm sure everyone is, because everyone's been eating in. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, look, I feel very fortunate to have been lucky to play sport for a living. I mean, playing sport for a living is not a job, it's a dream. And it's nice to still be involved and see people doing well and help others. So that's good. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. So Mike was saying about this 333 not out wine.
Not
that
out wine.
Going on.
Yes.
What's, well, that's what he said, like it, not drunk wine. I don't know. What's going on with that?
That's a good follow up with wine. 333 out wine and 333 not out wine. That'd be pretty good. Okay, so this happened about 5 years ago. A businessman in London, Nick Kent, bought a winery in the Languedoc in southwest France, near Metz, which is the a Tang de Thor, which is like a big lagoon, about 40 minutes south of Montpellier. Nice area, and he's a bit of a cricket fan, and he approached me about would I be interested in getting involved with him to have a little range of wines. So we went down there, we blended some wines. It's a very nice chateau called Domaine Saint-Hilaire, a 200-year-old winery. And we come up with 333, which is not the numbers, it's the words, 333 in words. And we have a Viognier, which I quite like, the white wines, one of my favourite white grapes. We have a Syrah, and then which, and then we have a rosé, which is like a Grenache blend. So that's it, really. And it's been going for 3 or 4 years now. We sell it at Essex, some other cricket venues, and some restaurants around here and there. He's a small producer, and he has other wines as well. So in my career, you know, as a professional cricketer, you play in Australia, great wineries down there in the Barossa Valley, the Clare Valley, the Hunter Valley, New Zealand in Otago, and the main one is where the Sauvignon Blanc comes from. My mind's gone blank.
In New Zealand?
Yeah, in New Zealand. Yeah. Marlborough. And then South Africa, obviously, you know, down in the Cape, in the wineries down there. So I've even played against Portugal in the Douro. Really? And I've played against France as well in Paris, just outside Paris. So
please tell me you won.
I think we did. A place called Chateau de Thoiry, 1991. This little ground, yeah, outside. I don't think there was any true Frenchmen playing that day, though. They were mainly expats and Asians with French passports, I think. But I think nowadays they have to have all that French passports. But so, yeah, cricket's an international game, and having a beer or a glass of wine in our generation was the done thing. I mean, obviously, modern sportsmen, it's a different regime now, you know. I'm not saying they don't have a drink. They do. And I'm not saying it's frowned upon. It's not. But it's not quite that sort of social get-together after the game like when we played. Now, I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that we used to get lashed every night after the game. That's not the case. But the socialising with the opposition team was the sort of done thing in county cricket and in test cricket when I played against the Australians, you know, in the 70s and 80s. You would generally have a beer with the opposition each night of the game. Now, it was a social thing, lasted maybe an hour in the dressing rooms, and it doesn't happen nowadays. They might get together at the end of a series in international cricket. It happens a little bit in county cricket, but not much. Most players come in a tracksuit, go home in a tracksuit. But of course, one of the big downsides about this not happening, it's not the alcohol, but mixing with the opposition, your contemporaries, your opposing players, this was a great learning curve for a sportsman.
Right.
This was a huge learning curve. Talking to them, listening, as a young player with Essex, listening to all the old players talk. If you were smart, you learned things about the game, about yourself, about what's happening in the game, and you picked up lots of information. And that goes back to that thing I said about knowledge, you know. It doesn't happen. You don't get that sort of engagement between other performers. And I think that's sad for a professional sportsman in a way.
Mm. No, I must admit, it's I always liked the sort of the social element of sport in the past. And it's surprising that they wouldn't have a drink after, let's say if you've got a 5-match series, they wouldn't have a drink after each match. They'd just have a drink at the end of the series.
I think that's pretty much what happens now. I mean, honestly, in Australia and in England, when I played against Australia, the end of the 70s through the 80s, generally you would go into, if you were the batting side, you would go into the opposition, the fielding side's dressing room each night for a quick beer with them. Yeah. It was the sort of done thing. And it was when I started professional cricket. Nowadays, obviously, that's not the case.
Mm.
Interesting.
Interesting. They're too busy using that throwing
machine. Well, they'd be running around the pitch and, you know, doing a bit of extra training, you know, whatever. But, you know, look,
in our era, we trained hard,
practice hard, play hard. And then some of us would have a beer hard as well. Some more than others, as you probably know.
Well, Graham, you know that I don't mind a drink or two as well. So you've been present to a few of my events.
I'd love to see you there.
Yeah, we're still here. Well, thank you, Graham. Okay. It's been really, really interesting. Really appreciate your time.
Lovely to speak to you. And unbelievable backdrop you've got in your place there.
Oh, I'm following Mike's lead on that.
That's
one.
Brilliant. That is brilliant.
Thanks for listening to Positive Personal Power. Do subscribe via your favorite podcasting app and please leave us a 5-star review. Or sign up on our website, positivepersonalpower.net, for weekly emails and updates, and do share our episodes with your friends and on social media. Feel free to reach out anytime.